And, you know, it seems like we're doing this every day, and we don't mean to pile on to Escobar, but Brett Beatty hit a grand slam tonight for Syracuse, and it seems like that's happening just about every day. Bounces away from Langoliers, but no chance for Vogelbach to think about advance.
I'm throwing the flag, Gary. What can you do? You just got to report
it. Just reporting it. And,
exactly.
You know, the fans are clamoring for Beatty to be called up, and the Mets will do it when they're, you know, when they're inclined to. We're 2 weeks into the season. There's no reason to, you know, be making any kind of move other than the one that's right. 1-1 to Escobar.
So you're saying that social media is not going to drive them to bring Beatty up before they want to?
There was a time when that might have been the case. I don't think in the current incarnation of the Mets brain trust that that is going to happen.
It's another edition of the Talking Mets podcast here on this Sunday, April the 16th, 2023. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. Send me a tweet at Mike Silva Media. And you can show an Apple Podcast, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. No G. Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. You can follow me on Instagram, talkingmets, no G. And I want to welcome in the good folks from the Fansided Podcasting Network as well as risingapple.com. Welcome to another edition of the Talking Mets podcast. Got a lot to get into today. Of course, the headline is Brett Beatty will be part of the big league roster. Our long national nightmare, I'm kidding, is finally over. So Brett Beatty will be part of the roster in less than 24 hours. We're going to get into that. I'm going to get into some honest conversation with you guys because I think we need to have it. I'm going to talk about our role. When I say our role, not just you, not just social media, myself included, in how the Mets run their business. I think I teased it a little bit in the open, the clip from Friday night, which, by the way, was probably, this is a non sequitur. I'm already starting with the non sequiturs, but probably was the worst game I've might have been the worst baseball game I've ever seen. A game the Mets won 17-6 and 3 hours and, what, 30 minutes or so. Not bad for a 17-6 game with 17 walks. Might have been the worst baseball game ever. But I teased it a little bit about what I'm going to talk about, an honest conversation. And then the second piece here with the Beatty promotion is really taking a hard look after 16 games where the Mets are. I know there's a lot of reason to be a little, I guess, cautiously optimistic or pessimistic, however you want to put it. They're 10-6. But the thing that I believe you feel is the problem with this Mets team, I'm not quite sure is the same problem what you and I are both thinking about. So we'll talk about that. And then Kurt McKnight, author, The Voices of Baseball, great book, gets into historic events in each of the 30 ballparks, catches up with a bunch of famous broadcasters, Hall of Fame broadcasters. We're going to get into a conversation about his project. It's that time of the year when baseball books come out. And let's face it, we have a ton of fun and, you know, really get into the weeds and talk about some real interesting topics every year, especially as you get into the April, May part of the season. All the new baseball books come out. We get some great authors on it. It spurs some good conversation. So we'll get into that. And how are the new rules impacting one of the two, I would say, enjoyments that we get from the sport, ballparks and going to the ballpark, and then broadcasting. Two things that we talk about all the time. And fortunately for us, as individuals who root for the Mets, cover the Mets, grew up watching the Mets, both of those things, maybe Shea wasn't the best place, but I've always felt that broadcasting in ballparks has been something that the Mets have always done well. Even when Shea wasn't the best ballpark, it was better than maybe some of the other multi-purpose stadium. So, and there was always a charm. So we'll get into that. Kurt McKnight, author, joining me in just a little bit. So let's start off with the honest conversation. And I got some feedback last week that I came across a little preachy, and I guess I could understand that, and that's fine. Look, I want honest feedback. If you guys listen to this show and you roll your eyes and you think I'm turning you off, I'm not going to get upset and mad. I take the feedback. I take it seriously. But I'm also honest about who I am and how I do the show. And basically, I am who I am. Was that Popeye? Am I quoting Popeye now? We're off to a roaring start. Non sequiturs, Popeye, everything, you know? We're kind of off to a roaring start. But one of the things that has really been bothering me for a while, and even last year, if you remember, I told you guys a bunch of times that I felt in a 101-win season, the actual fan base was pretty miserable and tough to take throughout most of the summer as the Braves were charging and coming and eventually taking over the division. A season where, yeah, it ended in disappointment and frustration. I would say more frustration than disappointment. Really should have been more enjoyable. And at times I felt, and you know, even Pete Alonso talked about this in spring training, that it seeped into the clubhouse, that maybe they didn't enjoy themselves as much as they should have, going through a real fun season. So I start to see already how the fan base very early in the season is taking every, you know, the game seven mentality with every game. And one of the things in our society right now is it's the social media and the mob nature of fans or customers or political activists, whatever you want to talk about, how they try to get together and they try to bully organizations into doing what they want. Whether it's the right thing and rooted in common sense, doesn't matter. This is what the public wants, and if we don't get what we want, we're just going to make your life miserable and try to put public pressure on you in order to move the needle to what we believe is the right thing. And you heard Gary Cohen and Ron Darling in basically the second inning. I took that clip, and I thought it was a beautiful clip. And at that point, we didn't know that Brett Beatty was going to get called up. But I felt, and I told you guys, by about May 1st would be the first marker whether Beatty was on the way up. And look, the things that we thought might happen, Escobar going into the tank. Look, I don't want to say he's Cano, but there are some signs, not as bad as Cano was last year. There are some signs that Escobar's on the way out, that he may be done as bad as slow. Not like Cano. Cano had some obvious signs, but it's something to look for. And with Beatty and some of the other prospects on the offensive side tearing up AAA, I mean, it's easy. It's easy for the fans to get excited. Everybody looks at stats and clips of home runs, and they think they're a scout. And let's face it, I'm not a scout. You're not a scout. There is so much more to evaluating a player's abilities at the next level. Most of us are not qualified to make that decision or even assess it on any kind of real level. This is the candy store of the candy store. We're having fun talking sports. And we try to be serious, we try to be professional, but I think the advent of analytics and how the bleeding of fan, independent media, media podcast into working in front offices has gotten a little blurry. Let's face it, since the Moneyball book came out, about 20 years ago. And I felt as I've watched social media specifically, and I don't even listen to talk radio, so I can only imagine, but you've got the typical talk radio heads going out there acting like, you know, I could influence decisions in this town, when that those days are long over. Talk radio has its place. It's put itself into a sphere where it's actually almost like a step. It's almost a step slightly above people calling into a talk show. I mean, there's really a very thin line between the host and the caller, and that's scary because the host should be the subject matter expert. Another conversation for another day. So as I watch, you know, whether it be on SNY or Twitter, you know, SNY.tv, I should say, people who are content creators, because I don't consider myself a content creator. I consider myself someone who does a really cool show, entertains you, gives you mental bubble gum, and I always pride myself on giving you things to think about whether you agree or disagree. I don't have the power to move the needle. You don't have the power to move the needle. You have the power to make lives miserable and to make this place a tough place to play, and believe me, we've all done that, and I don't think it's always justified, and it makes this task of winning a championship here that much harder. But let me be really straight. You want to go irrationally and demand that Mauricio and Beatty and Vientos or anybody else that's on that Syracuse roster gets brought up. But if you think by railing on it and harping on it and complaining about it and demanding that Epler gets fired is going to make a darn difference, then you're delusional. Because And Gary points it out in that clip that I played coming in. Maybe under the prior ownership, they had serious rabbit ears to what especially the media had to say. And maybe because the owner was a fan in the most impulsive bad way. Now, the current owner is a fan, but he's also understands the business part. And he's talked about that, how he'll watch the game, but he also has to take the long view. You know, he's as knee-jerk, and we'll see if he stays true to that as anybody else. This is an organization with a general manager who has, and we've talked about this a number of times, that there needs to be, I mean, everything that Billy Epler prides himself on is about probabilistic outcomes. And he talks about that. And in his mind, rushing Beatty or whatever the markers were that he felt that he needed to achieve, and clearly he's done that on the defensive side and the offensive side. We could see the numbers on the offensive side. Defensively, we saw some improvements late in spring training. He wasn't going to sacrifice any of that for what really would be incremental. What are they going to be, 11-5 instead of 10-6? You know, maybe a game or two. And you don't even know if that's the case. And I don't know if Beatty could be attributed to just that alone, bringing him up. And he's also got to stay true to the human aspect, which is a popular player, a leader in the clubhouse, a guy who has a long resume of hitting, a guy who down the stretch in September kind of helped carry the offense when Starling Marte was out. You just want to throw him off the island. And let's face it, we don't even know who's going to get thrown off the island here for Beatty. We know that he's going to be brought up. We know a roster move is going to be made. I'm sure the Mets didn't want that to get out. And it did. Martino got it. He seems to always get the news, the breaking news. He's always got his sources in there. That's the one guy I keep telling everybody, take seriously. He always seems to know what the Mets are doing. And it's been harder since Epler took over because the leaks have been less. So, you know, we don't know who they're going to throw off the island. Maybe it's LeCastro. Maybe it's a pitcher. I don't think it's going to be Escobar because, let's face it, the kid's going to need a blow. He's lefty. Who knows? I think Guillorme has options. Maybe Guillorme gets sent down. It's possible. We don't know. So what I really am trying to say here is that social media doesn't run the Mets. And you and I really are not qualified to know more or believe that we know more than Billy Epler. We could have an opinion about it. We could talk about it on this show. We could get mad about it. But we've really blurred the line. And there is a point where, and I think this is more because it's happening in society, in the real world, which is scary that that's where this has influence, that a baseball team is basically telling the customer, the fan base, hey, I'll run this. You go root. I appreciate your patronage, but let us handle the heavy lifting on the roster. Because in the real world, you could bully a company into making a decision just by some Twitter outrage by a very loud minority. And even in baseball and in the Mets, the Twitter verse and even the WFA and caller, they're the very small minority of people, small percentage of people calling to talk radio. Not the majority of society is on Twitter. Even though Elon Musk owns it and we act like he's like all of a sudden grabbed all these people in here, I think if you did a poll out of 10 people, I think, you know, maybe 3 or 4 are actually actively on Twitter. Now, if it depends on the age group, but you know what I'm saying. That's unscientific. So the honest conversation here is that sit back. You could root for the kids to come up because you want homegrown talent. But understand that no ranting and raving and no mob mentality is going to change the timeline that the Mets have or the belief that they have that a player is an asset to the 2023 Mets, or ever be an asset to the Mets in general. So I really appreciated what Ron and Gary said on Friday. They were all a little smug about it, and maybe they were preachy, just like maybe I'm being preachy again to take that feedback from last week's show. But I think it's important to have, and maybe some of you are in my camp and agree with me, but a really cold, hard hit in the face about our role when it comes to this team. We are not in the inner circle. We are not driving any kind of movement with this organization. The fan base is not going to run the show here. The owner may listen to them, and clearly he's probably meeting with his staff and saying, what do you think? But he's even said it himself. If you have me making the baseball moves, you got a problem. Because he's a fan, he's emotional. You saw that with the Correa situation. And then once he got dialed into the business part of it, look what happened. It didn't happen. So that's one. That's one thing I think. And I wanted to start there, and that's maybe a negative way to start, because let's face it, it was a great win, even though I know you're not happy how things went in Oakland, a couple of one-run wins against a team with really bad pitching. But let's also remember, the law of averages was going to eventually come into play here. And the law of averages was going to say, hey, the A's can't pitch to an ERA of 10 in the starting pitching. They're eventually going to have some sort of, regression or progression to the mean at that point. The second thing is, I really laugh that the offense is what you're all worried about. Now, Beatty is clearly going to help the offense. He's going to come in, and I don't expect him to have a 1,000 OPS, but if he could be anywhere near the player that, you know, I've heard he could be, he's improved enough where he's adequate defensively. If you're a Stratomatic fan, even if he's a 3 or 4 on defense, he makes the routine plays, and that's what you want. You're not expecting a gold glove there. You know, you want him to be, you know, solid at third, where the plays that should be made are made. And his bat can produce maybe what you were expecting Escobar to produce, which maybe he can't anymore. You know, the 106, 107, 108 OPS plus hits righties really well. Maybe you have to sit him a couple of times. That's where Escobar, if he's still on the roster, which I expect him to be, could spell him against lefties. Maybe that takes a little pressure. And maybe this takes pressure off Escobar. Maybe this whole thing takes pressure off Escobar. Where now, you know, the cat's out of the bag. Beatty's been brought up. The fans got who they wanted. The pressure is off of him because he's got his money. His role is his role. You know, we're all happy about the Knicks if you're a basketball fan in this town because they had a great game one victory over the Cavs. But look at what the Knicks did a month into their season. They benched Fournier, big money, starting shooting guard. They benched Derrick Rose, guy that arguably could be a Hall of Famer for some of the results he's had on the court over his career of about 15, 16 years. And they brought in kids that were on the bench and inserted them into the rotation. And look where the Knicks are now. Knicks have a chance to get into the second round of the playoffs and maybe make some noise and make some top-tier teams uncomfortable. I know it's basketball. It's not apples to apples, but the Mets can do the same thing. And they don't have to. The Knicks didn't do it after 5 games, 3 games, 4 games. They needed to see a sample size. And with Escobar, they've seen a sample size. Is Vientos next? Is Vogel back on the clock now? You know, Pham has made it really hard to want to bring anybody up to be that righty DH compliment because Pham is hitting the bar. All the metrics are, not only is he hitting, he's hitting the ball hard against lefties. He's giving you exactly what you wanted from Darren Ruff. And, you know, the kick in the you-know-what is that J.D. Davis, who I always loved, is out there in San Francisco hitting. So you can't, that's the guy you really could have played every day at DH, you know? So, but your real concern, and I'm going off on tangents here, but that's what this show's about. We're having fun. Your real concern's the offense. Mets are still averaging 4.7 runs per game, a tick below last year, above league average. Not much above league average. I mean, geez, the Rays are averaging 7 runs a game. I mean, I'm looking at some of these runs per game, and you got the Rays at 7, the Orioles nearly at 6, the Red Sox over 5. We're back to 1999 and steroids baseball. The Braves are over 5. Again, small sample size. But new rules clearly having an impact there, opening things up. Maybe some bad pitching as well, some bad teams. There's still some really bad teams here in the league. But the real thing that should worry you when it comes to the Mets is that their pitching is really not that good right now. Now, they're only giving up 4 runs per game. So they're, you know, from runs per game, they're in the top 10. But here's the thing that I believe really should worry you a little bit. Mets are slightly above league average on ERA plus in the pitching staff, slightly. The real thing that I believe, there's actually two things. John Harper brought this up over at SNY, and I'm going to bring up the other thing. First of all, the Mets, and we're talking about the entire league, all 30 teams, not just the National League, they are sixth highest, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, sixth highest in walks in all of baseball. All of baseball, they're sixth highest in walks. Want to know how ugly it gets? Let's look at the walks per 9 innings coming out of this staff. The bullpen, Dennis Santana, he's no longer part of the team, nearly 6 walks per 9. Drew Smith, 7 walks per 9. Ottavino, 4.5 walks per 9. A guy that actually worked on this last year, and it seemed to regress a little bit. Now, Rayleigh, 1.7, he's good. Curtis, 2.5, but he wasn't good today. Nagosik before he got hurt, 4.3. Tommy Hunter before he got hurt, 4.5. Max Scherzer is actually nearly 4 walks per 9. McGill, nearly 4 walks per 9. Kodai Senga, almost 6 walks per 9. Peterson, 5 walks per 9. Carrasco, 5 walks per 9. So this, it's really, I mean, the bullpen's not great, of course, but the starting pitching, which is going about 5 innings, is walking a batter per inning on average. Because, you know, 5 walks per 9, they're, you know, going about 5 innings, maybe not quite, maybe a little less than a batter per 9 innings, per 5 innings. And, you know, that's just not good. And that's not sustainable. And as you start to play better teams, look, you're able to navigate at Citi Field. Beautiful weather, so you know, but Citi Field stifles a lot of offense in April and May and June. And in general, Citi Field stifles a lot of offense in general. So even though it was the Padres and they easily could have lost all 3 games with the kind of walks that were making their way around the diamond in, against San Diego, including Scherzer, they didn't. But that doesn't mean the process and the outcome should, that you know, the process and the outcome don't always marry up. And I'm not saying it's dumb luck here that the Mets won, but there is a serious issue with the walks with this pitching staff that eventually they're not going to be in the top 10 in runs per game that they give up. They're going to be in the bottom third of the league in that. Now, I don't think all of this will continue. I'm assuming Scherzer is just getting load management here. I don't think Scherzer is going to continue to walk 4 per 9. I think Scherzer is figuring things out. I think a lot of what you see with the Mets during this phase where trying to figure out the getting to know you 2023 Mets is they've almost gone into April with extended spring training. Exactly what Buck talked a little bit about. He hasn't talked about it here. What I talked about back when pitchers and catchers came in was that with them scattered all about with a disjointed spring training, this was almost more of a difficult challenge for this club than the 2-week sprint that they had to opening day during the lockout last year. It's almost like extended spring training. Now, I think it helps. Having the ability to not play well, win ball games is a good sign. Yes, it's against maybe one of the worst teams we've seen in a long time. But first come from behind victory, Pete Alonso taking his game to the next level. You know, you're all worried about the offense. I'm worried about the pitching. And I could see the pitching sustaining these kind of numbers. You know, you think Senga is going to be any better with the walks? We talked about that. You know, McGill and Peterson, that's their MO. Carrasco, I told you, I wasn't crazy about him, especially against good teams. Before the season started, we ran through the numbers. I mean, the guy he expected who walked a ton of batters, especially when he went over to Philadelphia, Robertson, hasn't walked anybody yet. He's done his best, a little bit more contact, albeit a little bit more contact. He's done his best Edwin Diaz impression that you could have asked. Imagine if he was your setup man with Diaz. What a dynamic back end of the bullpen you would have. So, the offense to me, I don't expect Jeff McNeil to have an 81 OPS plus. I don't expect Thomas Nito to hit 107 the entire year. Marte and Nimmo are kind of getting into their own. You're not going to have a guy hitting 114 at third base. I mean, you can't imagine Beatty doing any worse than Escobar. Canna, a big part of last year's offense, well below his career norms. Vogelbach and what he could do against right-handed pitching. And a little unlucky with the lined out. He could have really cleaned up with the bases loaded today. 79 OPS plus. So there's still room for improvement on offense. And you already saw they're pretty much averaging what you expected at 4.7 runs per game, which is fine, but not fine if you're going to walk the amount of batters that they've walked, because that negates what they were built on. Strong starting pitching, a strong bullpen, and an elite closer. You want to take away the elite closer and say it's a very good closer with Robertson? Yes. You can't win with this type of offense, a contact-driven offense, really good defense. They're not going to sacrifice defense for offense. A good balance between offense and defense on the positional side, you can't win with that if your pitchers are walking the ballpark. That's what should be bothering you, and nobody's talking about it. John Harper touched on it a little bit, but what he touched on was in context of the starters not going deep. That is an epidemic across the entire rotation, with the exception of Robertson. Okay, Curtis gave up the lead in the eighth inning. What did it start with? A walk. Yakabonis got into trouble. Nimmo bailed him out. What did it start off with? A walk. Walks will kill. Walks will kill. It's like having, you know, physical issues, you know, heart issues, and stuffing yourself with bad food. You're exacerbating a problem. Not to take lightly anyone's health issues. I'm just giving you an analogy here. So keep complaining and thinking that, you know, it's the offense. Celebrate that Beatty's here and you think he's a savior. He's not going to be. He's going to help. Nobody could be a savior on the offensive side or the defensive side if the walks continue, because there's no offense that overcomes a high level of walks. There's no defense that could stop a walk. And you can't dance around runners on base. You could do it in Oakland against a lineup that is pesky, but not very good. You can't do it against Atlanta. Once the Phillies figure things out, you're not going to do it when Harper gets back in that lineup. Shoot, you might not even be able to do it against Miami. What, you know, San Diego, you think when you go out in the West Coast and you go on the, into their ballpark, especially in the summer, you don't think the ball's going to go flying with Soto and Machado and Bogarts and so on and so forth? You know? So I don't want to be negative because, look, the Mets are in a pretty good place after 16 games, considering that they haven't really even come close to making you feel like they're playing playoff baseball. Not forget championship baseball, playoff-level baseball. Do I think this team smells and looks to me like a team that over the long haul could compete with the Braves? No, I don't think they could win a division. I don't see that, but it's only 16 games in. I see a team that can make the playoffs, and I see a team that's going to have to figure some things out, and probably during that early season figuring things out, they're going to lose their opportunity to win this division. They look more like a wild card team to me. They don't look as strong as the 2022 Mets, and I just laid it out to you. You know, they didn't have DeGrom for most of the season. Okay, and they didn't have Scherzer for most of the season, but they weren't putting runners on base to the level that they've done now with guys like Walker, Carrasco, Bassett, you know, when Trevor Williams subbed in. Even Peterson and McGill were a little bit better on that front last year. So is this correctable? Is this who they are? We'll see. Because if it is, then this is not going in a good direction. The amount of walks this staff has given up is a problem. Period, end of story. And that's the story. The walks are the problem, and the walks will derail the pitching, and that kind of pitching cannot be saved with the kind of offense that's built here. Even if they were the Colorado Rockies of 1999 and 1998, you're not going to win. You can't win with that kind of pitching. You can't make the playoffs with that kind of pitching. You'll be mediocre at best. So enjoy it now. Enjoy the Beatty situation, but realize the real issue is not going to be solved by Brett Beatty walking through that door in L.A. tomorrow. That's only going to be solved by these guys performing better. And maybe these are over-indexed in a bad way numbers that are going to swing to the other side. Let's hope. Just like Oakland starting pitching did a little bit the last couple of days. But something's got to give. So, all right, let's take a quick break. Kurt McKnight, author, The Voices of Baseball. Voices of the Game, not Voices of Baseball. Voices of the Game should be what I say. You know, here it is. The guy comes on the show. I get his book wrong. Kurt McKnight, the Voices of Baseball. I'm sorry. The Voices of Baseball is the book. Get that. I got to get that right. Anyway, Kurt McKnight, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Kurt McKnight's going to join us. We're going to get into some of the conversation about baseball, broadcasting, and ballparks. Baseball and ballparks, broadcasting, all that stuff, some of the favorite topics I got there. Little clunky way to exit. Got myself a little bit riled up here about the walks. That's what happens. When you walk a lot of batters, even the Talking Mets podcast gets off track. All right, let's take a quick break. We'll be back with more right after this. The Talking Mets podcast is available on many outlets, but the most popular is Apple Podcast. Hi, I'm Mike Silva, the host of the Talking Mets podcast, and I encourage you to leave a review about the program on Apple. Just rate it 1 to 5 stars, hopefully a 5 because why wouldn't you? And then if you have time, leave a review. It helps the podcast continue to grow and encourages others to take a listen. You can also email me at MikeSilva@TalkingMetsPodcast.com. No G, TalkingMetsPodcast.com. Hope to hear from you soon. And enjoy the rest of the show. We're back, and joining me, Kurt McKnight, author of a great book, The Voices of Baseball, the game's greatest broadcasters reflect on America's pastime. And Kurt, welcome to the program. You are hitting on two of my favorite topics, and two of the topics that no matter what time of the year, baseball fans can discuss. broadcasters, and ballparks. It doesn't get better than that, and that's why baseball is a great game. I know you've done books on hockey. You believe Dale Murphy should be in the Hall of Fame, so you're a great Hall of Fame guest. I mean, I know we've spoken before in the past, but we'll put the Hall of Fame and we'll put the NHL to the side, despite the fact it's playoff time. Ballparks, broadcasters, the voices of baseball, and a tribute to Vin Scully. Can't get better than that. Welcome to the program, and how are you?
I'm good. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So what made you do this, the voices of baseball? What made you get into, you know, it's interesting. You have great broadcasters, so much Met connections in there. I mean, from all the different teams. Mm-hmm. And obviously ballparks in the 30 ballparks. Talk a little bit about how you wove all that stuff together.
Well, baseball now is the only sport that there is no just absolute uniformity. You know, no ballpark is the same as the next all down the line. You know, back when we were having these multi-use ballparks, the cookie cutters, if you will, you would have four different ballparks, three at the very least that are exactly the same. You know, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, and Cincinnati were all the exact same ballpark, same dimensions. Like you could basically just film a movie and pretend you were having a pirate story, but you really were filming it in Philadelphia or Cincinnati. That's just how it was. You know, unless you went outside and saw everything around, you were feeling like you were in the same ballpark. So, you know, I feel like baseball is one of those things where people really go there for the structures. You know, you go to a basketball game, once you go inside the arena, it's all the same. You know, once you go into a football stadium, unless, you know, you're talking about Sophie Stadium out there in LA and some of these other ones, a lot of times for the longest time, you'd be doing the same thing, you know, but with a ballpark, you have this unique structure. You have all these different things that make one city different than the next. And it's not just this architecture. It's the altitude. It's things like the marine layer, you know, the weather takes effect. So different things, the ball plays different ways. And so you want to talk about those kinds of things, but you want to do it in a way that makes people interested. And me talking about all this stuff, obviously the last minute and a half is not interesting, but you get somebody like Vin Scully, Dick Enberg, John Miller. I mean, I'll drop names all day. For the Mets, you get Howie Rose. These guys are so smart and they're so versed in what they do. So they are able to basically not only give a description of it, all of it, but walk you through it in the same way. You know, we all can be laymen when it comes to these kinds of things, but these guys have a way of basically conceptualizing it in a way that we can understand.
Do you have a favorite story, a favorite ballpark? And you could be honest, does it have to be the Mets one with Howie Rose and Wayne Hagen and Johan Santana's no-hitter? That was a great night, but may not, you know, it was in the middle of a season that things weren't expected. The ballpark wasn't full. It wasn't a playoff game. And that's more local. And that's about baseball. You know, things that local that are a big deal or maybe not a big deal across the sport. Going through this, going through each team's history, speaking to a number of broadcasters, hitting on all these ballparks, was there one that stood out to you more than another?
Well, I mean,
I know that's hard because you got so many great stories in this book.
It really is hard, but you know, it's easy to just fall back on somebody like Vin Scully calling you in the middle of the afternoon and saying, "Hi, I'm Vin Scully. I broadcast Dodgers baseball," like as if I didn't know who it was when he said hello. So, I mean, that's one story right
there.
That's
surreal. That's surreal.
That's surreal. The guy says hello. I see my caller ID, Los Angeles, California. There's 9 million people or whatever in Los Angeles. He says hello. I know exactly who it is. And so that's one story. An actual interview that really kind of shot me through the gates was one of my first interviews, and it was with the first Hall of Famer I interviewed for the book, and that's Eric Nadell. And we did the interview during spring training in the ballpark for the Rangers out in Surprise, Arizona. We were, you know, he wasn't actually in the booth. He had the day off that day. So we're sitting there and there's Ranger fans below us in the row below us. And they are just, I have no idea what's going on, that I feel like, oh, we are just talking too loud. These people are getting really bugged. They're trying to watch this game. Well, we do the interview. We're talking baseball for 30 minutes, 35 minutes. He gets up, he walks off. This couple immediately gets up and comes up to me, and I'm sitting there thinking, oh my gosh, like did we just ruin your game? I don't have a way of refunding your tickets. They're like, we really loved your interview. We're Ranger fans, and we immediately recognize Mr. Nedell. When does your book come out? So to me, that carried so much momentum going in. I thought, wow, this is exactly what I'm trying to encapsulate with this book. The fact that this is an identifiable voice. This is somebody these guys tune into every day. This is an insight these guys want to get. And so that really catapulted not only the way that I approach the book, but also that I was thinking, these guys go way back too. I don't have to just talk about ballparks of today. We could talk about ballparks of yesterday. And that's another chapter of the book, is talking about 10 or 11 of the ballparks of yesterday and the broadcaster's memories there.
That's really interesting because, and by the way, we have Kurt McKnight. You can check out Kurt on Twitter at The Voices of MLB. The book is The Voices of Baseball. When you bring up the intimacy of the announcing team, and again, I've covered the sport in general. I've covered New York baseball, but I'm doing Mets now, and I have been since 2016. Mets are one of the perfect examples. I mean, the Gary, Keith, and Ron, 18 years running together, actually a record with a trio, you know, for the Mets. It's almost like they're part of your family. You know, you can't wait to hear about Keith Hernandez's stories about his cat Haji or his complaints about driving from Sag Harbor to the ballpark. You know, Ron's, you know, thoughtfulness, Gary Cohen's excitement. I mean, even now, thanks to the technology and Twitter and Dunkin' Donuts sponsoring it, they'll show you a snapshot of the booth and their reactions of a big play. So you could see Gary throw the pen or Keith and Ron look at each other like, I told you so. They become part of your family. I'm ruined. You know why I'm ruined? Vin Scully's like, as a young Mets fan, 86 World Series and all those big postseason games in the 80s, Vince Scully's voice. Even Joe Garagiola, Al Michaels. I mean, these are great announcers. I had Bob Murphy growing up. Gary Cohen takes over. Tim McCarver, Steve Sabritsky, Gary Thorne, you know, Ralph Kiner. To me, these are people that I don't know. You didn't know Vince Scully, but they're part of your family. And you just explained the connection there with Vince Scully calling you. Baseball, I love the NBA, and I know you wrote about the NHL, and we could talk about Clyde Frazier and John Davidson with the Rangers. Again, I'm doing a New York perspective on this. But nothing is like baseball announcers. I'm biased, but I'm curious your thoughts on that.
No, you're right. Nothing is like them because baseball, well, this is a different season coming into it. Like the announcers, the broadcasters are having to readjust. Sure. They've gotten to be, you know, and I think they like it. They like the pace of the game going the way it is. And now they're having to readjust back to the way it used to be. You know, there's things that, that they have, you know, embedded into their DNA over years that were kind of plucked out with the game slowing down so much. And now that we're getting back into that, you know, I was in a broadcast during spring training, and they basically planned to have me on for a half inning. It was like a 6-pitch half inning. And I can't,
you couldn't even get a foul ball, Kirk. I mean, here's your big moment in the sun. You can't even get a foul ball.
Exactly. And so, yeah, I couldn't get a foul ball. The funny thing was I was in the Padres broadcast, and the inning before they scored 5 runs. And I said, golly, you guys, I could have read the book in that inning, you know, and that is okay. That is okay because these guys are pros and they know how to adapt and to adjust. And so they're going to be able to do these kinds of things. It is going to basically put them back on the front of their feet and on the back. But that's all right. You know, a lot of these guys, these newcomers, who knows, but you know, when you have the guys who have been there 40 or 50 years, you know, Eric Nedell even told me, he's like, I'm interested to see what happens going into this season with this pitch clock. You know, I talked to him over the off season for the updated edition with the Rangers. So you could tell that this is a big part of their way of doing things. And so when you have this change back to it, you know, you are going to see these broadcasters adapt to it. And, you know, these promos, these sponsors, they're going to have to wait until the middle of the inning because it's just going so fast. If you want somebody to talk like the FedEx guy from the 80s, going blah, 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 micro machines, whatever.
Right, you know, right.
You're not going to get your promo in, but that's going to be how it has to be until the end of the inning right now because the game has just sped back up.
Yeah, and I was even thinking about this because that was something I was going to talk to you about the adjustment and the easy breezy conversational nature of baseball that may be taken away. as we get deeper into the month of April, I feel like the new rules, which were such a big topic, have fallen into the background. The game is faster, but it's still 2.5 hours. I mean, yeah, you have your 220s. You know, the Yankees lost 11-2 in 2 hours and 20 minutes. That's just eliminating the unnecessary drudgery that, you know, everybody's just trying to, like, sloth through a blowout. You still got 2 hours and a half, 2 hours and 40 minutes, about the time that, you know, you and I are pretty much contemporaries age-wise. I'm in my mid-40s, that you would watch a game maybe up until the year 2000. And I don't remember it being too fast. I don't remember storytelling not being a part of that. So I don't think that that's being taken away. And I don't think the new rules have taken away because they're professionals, because they've adjusted. I don't feel like it's taken so much away. Now, your six-pitch inning, yeah, that's going to happen. But that happened in the past. And maybe that six-pitch inning wasn't 3.5 minutes. Maybe it was 10 minutes because of fiddling with the gloves and everything. But I don't think it's hurting the game, and I'm not here to talk about the new rules, but I'll talk about it in context of your project and broadcasting. And it's something I've talked about on today's show as well. People are starting to complain about, well, now you're ruining my ballpark experience. Well, you can't have two experiences. You can't have the quick game, great broadcasting, and a beer line that you don't miss anything. You can't have it all. So I don't see it as impacting. Long-winded conversation here. I don't see it as impacting where going forward, you can't have what we've experienced in baseball booths because of the new rules. I am concerned about the next wave of announcers. That's another story, but I'll let you take the first one.
No, I think I would be concerned about the next wave of announcers because these guys go to school for this kind of stuff. You know, they go to school for these kinds of cues and things like that. But yeah, there, you just touched on something as far as the concourses and beer lines and stuff like that. You know, you see on these Twitter pages or Facebook pages, these people are like, I am getting my food and my beer and in my seat by first pitch because, you know, a 20 minute line will take me out of a full inning and a half sometimes. So, you know, it really does have a ripple effect. And yes, I feel like it's great for the game because retention is what it's all about in this society. You know, people are just too overstimulated within 5 seconds of tuning into something. And if they're not, they're tuning out. And so, yeah, I think it's great for the game. And yes, they will get their stories. And that's what I'm trying to say is that they are very fine tuned and they're very disciplined in their craft. And that's something that they go to school to learn to do. Now you can't go to the school of Harry Carey, great figure, great personality, but goodness, the guy just wandered so much. And that's one of the things, but that's what we loved about him. And that's what we love about certain broadcasters is the way they carry about the game, because sometimes you're just lost. You're just lost of what's going on. If you're tuning into the radio, luckily Harry was on TV a lot of times. So people are like, well, I see what's happening. He's talking about Cracker Jacks, but I can see that there's a runner on base. I can see that so-and-so is on, you know, on deck and so-and-so is at the plate. Luckily, you know, because sometimes that's what happens. You go down this rabbit hole I personally think that these guys are going to be able to excel if they know how to toe the line and know how to do it. These guys that are coming up.
Yeah. And now with score bugs and base running bugs, mm-hmm. Harry Carey would be even more popular because you're probably screaming at the TV back then. Like, hey, Harry, man, how many strikes, how many balls, how many outs, things like that. You know, the thing, and I guess this is more of a Mets thing, because you talk to in this book, McCarver, Gary Thorne, Howie Rose. What scares me a lot, it's interesting, is that, look, Gary, Keith, and Ron are getting older. They're not going to do this forever. At least all three of them. Howie Rose is getting older. He's not going to do this forever. Bob Murphy, long gone. You know, preceded them. Ralph Kiner, long gone, preceded them. Lindsey Nelson. You know, I could go on. Since 1962, the Mets only have 2 championships. But they've had a ton of success in the broadcast booth. I don't know if you can hold up that bar for the next 60 years. Mets are 60 years old. 60 years from now, I won't be here. Maybe you. I won't be. Well, if I'm here in 60 years at 100 talking to you, the show's going to be a lot different, right? So what will the broadcasting look like? Now, they put Keith Radd in the booth and Pat McCarthy. Good Keith, I know, when he was in Brooklyn, and I've spoken to him as a Brooklyn Cyclones announcer, you know, Brooklyn in the area has that New York feel. Pat McCarthy has, you know, being
you know, from Tom's broadcasting tree, has the chops, you know, so to speak, you know, that's in you. Yeah. But with, you know, all these conglomerates taking over, it can't just be about the schooling. It can't just be about the mechanics. There has to be a connection. I'm not saying you have to be a homer. There has to be personality. And I worry, and you would be the best guy to ask this because you spoke to so many of these guys. It doesn't mean you have to be Keith Rad, who's not a ball player, or Keith Hernandez, who was a ball player. It's about the connection and about how you connected to this fan base. And it doesn't mean you have to be a Mets ball player or a Yankees if you were doing the Yankees, but you have to have a connection to that. You know, Ken Singleton, it was a Yankees broadcaster. He didn't play for the Yankees, but he became Jim Cott, did not play for the Yankees, became synonymous with Yankee baseball. You can do that. And Bill White, another example. So I worry, you know, a little bit about broadcasting going forward because you don't necessarily have people in the business side that get what you and I are talking about here.
But you also are in such a huge market. That's another thing. New York, to me, it's like, I mean, I'm going to quote Sterling quoting Vin Scully because, you know, he says, you know, Sterling was talking to Scully about, you know, being out in Los Angeles, you know, and it's, he's like, yeah, you got the Mets and the Yankees. That's what this, you know, Scully says to Sterling, you guys have the Mets and the Yankees. Out here, the Angels might as well be in Kansas City. Like, he's basically saying it's just us out here, you know, but in the New York market, it's so huge and it's great, you know, but when you go to the smaller markets, like Kansas City, for example. Wow. I mean, they just love them, you know, to death. And I feel like, you know, in New York, I have nothing against New York. I think I love New York baseball, the Yankees and Mets. I love basically the fact that they're both contenders year in and year out now. I feel like it's good for baseball. It's good for marketability. It's good for viewership. And I know that a lot of people taking on that role and taking on that mantle on these big market things that they, you know, they realize going in that they're like, they're stepping into the deep end right now. And so, and they can be under a microscope a lot of the times because sometimes fans can just be unforgiving. Hockey fans are ridiculous. I love hockey. Hockey fans will put you under a microscope. It's so crazy. They will just totally tear apart just the slightest thing that you say that they don't feel is completely in line. And so, you know, sometimes when you have that going in, you know, it really kind of gives a little trepidation and things like that. But, you know, the Mets, the bottom line is the Mets get this for, you know, this year, for example, when Familia got hurt during the WBC, I don't know if you saw this. There's just this YouTube video or whatever. This guy is just dropping F-bombs left and right after, you know, it's a Met fan. I know you.
I know who he is. Frank the Tank. Yeah, so, we know Frank.
And so you have things like that and those things go viral, you know? Sure. And so, and a great story, for example, Wayne Hagen talking about, this was in the original edition, talking about Shea. The last game at Shea, he says, I don't know what was worse, the language of these kids on the subway ride home or the language of their parents after this Mets loss, because he said it was the worst and foulest language he'd ever heard in his life on that subway ride home because, you know, they had the chance to actually possibly make the postseason that last game and they didn't. You know, it was the last game ever at City and it was just such a bad way to end, or not last game at City, last game at Shea, and it was just such a bad way to close the book on Shea Stadium. And I think that New York gets the bad reputation of having those kinds of stories, but they also have great fans who are diehard and loyal. So as a broadcaster, you can also say, I can't ask for better fans because they know who I am and they know all about me. You explaining all these things about the three in the Mets booth. I love Ron Darling because he sounds like James Woods. I feel like I'm listening to James Woods call a baseball game and it's awesome. And Ron Darling is very smart and he's very fun to listen to. I listen to him a lot on the TBS broadcast when they do playoff baseball. So, you know, I identify with him in that way. Gary Thorne was always a great voice for the Mets. But I know Gary for his hockey and I know Gary for Baltimore. You know, I didn't, you know, back when Gary broadcast for the Mets, it wasn't as readily available across the country as things are right now. That's one thing that a lot of people need to understand is that, you know, back here in the West, we had Scully in the Dodgers. That's what we had because there was no internet There was no MLB network. There was none of that. And so you guys have your own markets and you guys have your own little bubble and community in each baseball town.
Yeah. And, you know, going back to hearing you talk about Vin Scully calling you, it reminds me of when I interviewed many, many years ago. I'm going back 15, 16 years when Ernie Harwell and I spoke, when Ernie Harwell had a compilation. And as I'm talking to him, and this is early in my doing, you know, I didn't go to school for this. I kind of took my business learnings and got into this thing and got kind of lucky. I'm talking to Ernie Harwell, who I didn't listen to growing up as a Mets fan. And all I know is here's a guy that started broadcasting when Ty Cobb was around and Babe Ruth was around, spoke to those players. And the enormity of it overwhelmed me a little bit because I'm like, I'm talking to somebody who talked to Ty Cobb. Ty Cobb, who is not Ty Cobb in the movie, not a Ty Cobb that's on a baseball card that's, you know, basically a cartoon drawing. Or not the Ty Cobb that we've heard about that's basically a fiction character because you haven't experienced them, the Ty Cobb. And I got to think Vin Scully calling you, the humility of him announcing himself as if you would not know, like he would be calling someone, "Hi, Vin Scully, Los Angeles Dodgers announcer," as if you, like you said, you didn't know. They broke the mold with that one. You know, I have to say now that he's passed, and I was not a Dodgers fan, of course, and didn't listen to him on Dodgers broadcast, but he was the voice of national playoff baseball for me growing up. Not Joe Buck and McCarver. That was later on. It was Vin Scully. And it's almost like that's the standard. I don't think that ever that's the Mariano Rivera of broadcasting. That's the Babe Ruth or whatever you want to say, the best player of all time of broadcasting. That's who it'll be. And I think the day I die, that's who it'll be. And I got to think there's more to that interaction. There had to be a surreal nature like I had with Ernie Harwell many years ago to you talking to Scully, like you just talked about.
Yeah, there was, because when you're talking to Scully, he has this just steel trap memory. He's talking to me about, I believe her name was Hilda Chester back in the Ebbets Field days. And he's talking about her as if he had just ran into her on the street the day before. We're talking 2014 was my interview with Vin Scully, and that, you know, they hadn't played in Ebbets Field since 58.
Sure.
So we're talking 56 years. And so, and he's talking about just like it's yesterday. And he's also talking about the Polo Grounds, growing up and being in the Polo Grounds. You know, we're talking about a guy who is called, I think it was 23 no hitters in his career,
right.
I believe, you know, however many world championships and then however many World Series. I mean, they even just had the plot hole of all plot holes, having a Tigers Yankees game on For the Love of the Game.
Yep.
Called by
having
Vince
him.
Scully.
Yeah.
Like what?
Like it was, they did that as if he was doing the national Saturday afternoon broadcast. And I'll tell you, that movie, I've always said that movie's a perfect movie because it gives you the great date movie. You could bring your significant other who doesn't care about baseball that gets the love story. And as a baseball fan, I remember watching that. I went to the movie theater to watch that. You have a real dramatic baseball story. Is Kevin Costner, Billy Chappell going to get the perfect game? Yeah. And who better to do it than Scully? Not Joe Buck and McCarver. And I love Tim McCarver. God rest his soul. Just passed recently. I didn't hate Joe Buck. There's memories of Joe Buck and McCarver doing national broadcasts. I mean, when you think of Yankees Red Sox at its height, 04, 03, you think of those two guys announcing David Ortiz big hits, yeah, or, you know, the Aaron Boone walk-off. Mm-hmm. So there's a certain era, depending, and that's the interesting part, because the national broadcast, depending on who your team is, you have memories of broadcasters based on eras. For me, Vin Scully is more 80s. Whereas Buck and McCarver is connected to the 04 Yankees, Red Sox, 03 Yankees, Red Sox. You just connect them to eras and things like that.
Well, and for this new edition, like we're talking about these baseball games, you know, you're talking about it's meant to be the baseball game of the week. Well, Bob Costas is now in this edition. And Bob was calling the game of the week back in 84, and it was the Ryan Sandberg game. And that is a game, mm-hmm, that's just stood the test of time, even, you know, almost 40 years later, because he said that not less than three documentaries have been made, you know, local Chicago or wherever it be, on that actual game. that's a game of the week. That's not even a playoff game. You know, the Cubs went on to go to the playoffs that year and everything like that. But, you know, and I think that was the year that Steve Garvey and the Padres knocked him out, went to the World Series to basically get blown away by the Tigers. But
right.
Regardless, you know, that is one thing about broadcasting, though, is on any given day, you can have a national broadcast like that on an NBC game of the week, and it can be something that's just immediately legendary.
Sure.
You know, that game was a back and forth. I think
they beat Bruce Sutter, if I remember correctly.
Bruce Sutter, and yeah. Also the Cardinal hitter had hit for the cycle that day. And in a losing effort, you know, like how often do we see somebody hit for the cycle in a losing effort?
Sure.
And so you take just moments like that and you just throw them into a basket. And I think that's what the book is just that, like, you know, you're trying to talk to somebody and they love their team and they only want to hear about their team. That's great. But you gotta open up your heart to baseball. It's kind of like at the end of, Moneyball, when he says, how could you not be romantic about baseball, when they're talking about the player, you know, he's showing him the tape of the player who tripped rounding first base and it was all like mortified, but it was, you know, and he's like scrambling, get back to the base. And turns out he'd hit a home run, you know, and just the team is just egging him on and laughing and all that. And he's just like, how can you not be romantic about baseball? I agree. How can you not be romantic about baseball? Thank you, Aaron. Oh, I can't think of Aaron's last name now. Sorkin. Thank
Aaron
you.
Sorkin.
Sorkin. Yeah. So I appreciate it.
Couple things before we wrap up. Was there a broadcaster that you learned about that, you know, maybe surprised you a little bit? Cause, you know, obviously, you know, Vin Scully, you know, John Sterling, you know, these big names, but is there a broadcaster that you interacted with that has, you know, surprised you, like, wow, that guy's a lot better than I thought, or something different maybe that you learned?
Well, okay. So, Brian Anderson, who broadcast TV for the Milwaukee Brewers, he is somebody that I called the newbie in the original edition of the book, because we're talking Vin Scully was in his 62nd or 63rd, 60, he was in his 65th season. So it's 2 years before he retired. So, and you got, you know, other guys like John Miller and all these guys that have 40, 50 years experience. And then, you know, Brian was kind of like newer to, he was kind of the junior member of the firm, as John Sterling would say. And I mean, goodness, that guy is lights out. They bring that guy across all sports to be there. And if you tune into NCAA, NBA playoffs, and baseball, you're going to find Brian Anderson on those national televised TBS, basically. You know, Ernie Johnson, who I talked to for my Del Murphy book, just has nothing but praise for Brian Anderson. So, you know, he may have been the newbie, but in these last 8 or 9 years, he has grown to be basically the guy to go to, especially for TBS. They, you know, Ron is on TBS. Obviously, we already mentioned Ron being on there. Brian's on there with him. You know, these guys, I mean, who can ask for more than this? You know, these guys are the guys that you want in there. They're no nonsense, but they're also able to encapsulate everything that you want out of a broadcast, but also not bore you to death and really just kind of let you know the things you need to know. So I would have to say Brian Anderson's the answer to that question.
Interesting. So obviously people could go to Amazon and get the book or the local bookstore, I'm assuming, but you have an interesting promotion at Roman and Littlefield. That's your publisher, or roman.com. Let everybody know. Well, two things. Let everybody know about the book, where they could get it. And as I'm talking to you, two things I have to ask, because we're on camera. The audience can't see that. And you kind of sparked this before we went on air. You got a Blue Jays hat. So I'm assuming you might be a Blue Jays fan. Now, I have a St. John's hat. I went to St. John's. I tried not to wear a Mets hat while I'm doing these things, because that's a homer thing. I'm not a homer. This is a Mets, Talking Mets podcast. We're independently trying to talk about the Mets, even though I have the passion of a fan. Behind you have what I think is the old school magnetic standings board of all the smorgasbord. I can't see. They don't look like baseball magnets. Maybe they are. So tell us a little bit about where to get the book. And you have a pretty cool promotion at your publisher, which I think people should take advantage of. And, you know, are you a Blue Jays fan? Is Joe Carter? Is there a Joe Carter poster somewhere? And your magnets and all that stuff.
Okay, so Roman, that's Roman with a W. And then use the coupon code RLFANDF30. and you'll get 30% off the book. Now, Blue Jays, Whit Merrifield is now a Blue Jay. Whit Merrifield is my favorite player. I followed him a lot in Kansas City. Always have him on my fantasy team. He's fantasy gold. He had a struggling year last year, which I was surprised that they even traded him.
Yep.
But the way that the game has changed, Whit, this is Whit's game now. And you'll see his numbers have gone up, and the Blue Jays are going to be happy they have him. They're probably going to be moving him up a couple spots in that lineup, but still, Whit Merrifield is why I wear this Toronto Blue Jays hat. And then I have 135 magnets for college football. Now, whether or not I ever do a Voices of College Football book, that's a question for another day. But having it out there and having it here around me and just kind of being surrounded by it, it just always kind of has this lingering sense of it could happen one day. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. But just keep it on, at the very least, the back burner. So this is my back burner.
There you go. Well, listen, this has been great. Two of my favorite topics, ballparks and broadcasters, gives us gold. You know, this is what doing baseball podcasting and baseball talk during the season. You can't do like football and it's like, you know, breakdown, week one, week two, week 15. It's okay. Mets are in Oakland. It's April. Nothing to get, you know, there's no controversy to drive the show. Let's talk about something that's topical that you could listen to in August, this segment, even though it's done in April, and you did a great job. So thanks a lot. Thanks a lot for joining us. Let's catch up again. Maybe during Hall of Fame time, we'll see. You know, maybe you'll eventually get Dale Murphy in a Hall of Fame, you know?
It, so, it may be.
You know,
oh, I forgot. I didn't even mention Amazon. You can get this book anywhere online books are sold. So I guess I should definitely, I'd be remiss if I didn't include Amazon in that too.
Yeah, there you go. Well, Kurt, have a great Sunday. Thank you so much for joining us. I know you're up against the time here. Let's do this again. Keep in touch and appreciate you thinking of us. All righty.
Thank you. Thanks Take for having care, me.
And that's Kurt McKnight. You can check him out on Twitter at the Voices of MLB, at the Voices of MLB on Twitter. And the book, go to Roman and Littlefield at www.romanwithaw.com. You get a great promotion, as he said, and obviously you get the book on Amazon. We're going to take a quick break, wrap up. I'll get into a little commentary about what we just talked about. As I said in the open, you don't want to get into the new rules and how it has impacted the experience of watching and listening to baseball in the ballpark at home, and maybe a little bit about that. You're listening to the Talking Mets podcast. We'll be back with more right after this.
The Talking Mets podcast is available on many outlets, but the most popular is Apple Podcast. Hi, I'm Mike Silva, the host of the Talking Mets podcast, and I encourage you to leave a review about the program on Apple. Just rate it 1 to 5 stars, hopefully a 5 because why wouldn't you? And then if you have time, leave a review. It helps the podcast continue to grow and encourages others to take a listen. You can also email me at MikeSilva@TalkingMetsPodcast.com. No G, TalkingMetsPodcast.com. Hope to hear from you soon. And enjoy the rest of the show.
All right, we're back. Final thoughts. Appreciate Kurt McKnight coming on and talking about some of his experiences catching up with. It's a great book, The Voices of Baseball. I mean, just go through the introduction and look at each chapter and see who he had a chance to sit down and talk with. Forget Vin Scully, but you know, up and down every team, you know, just broadcasters that you love to get some insight in. And I mean this when I say it, the one thing the Mets have always done well on the media side is with their broadcast team, dating back to 1962. And I heard a little bit of Keith Radd and Pat McCarthy about an inning and a half, maybe an inning or so, and they're not bad. And if you're going to have a backup to Howie Rose, not a bad, you know, McCarthy with great bloodlines there. You know, Keith Radd been on this show, you know, typical story that you'd love to see. A guy who was the Cyclones announcer and gets the call up. He gets called up to the big leagues. I mean, just like the players. So the next generation, which I am concerned about, as you get a lot of these corporations, you hope with a Steve Cohen as the owner, if he has the impact on the broadcast teams. Now, he doesn't own SNY, and he doesn't own the radio station, but maybe his influence at some point can make sure that this tradition continues when the Cohens, the Hernandezes, the Darlings retire. I mean, they're not going to go on forever. Howie's not going to do this forever. I mean, we grew up. I mean, Howie Rose, you know, you're going back to 1986, 87 when the fan came into play. He's been part of the Mets fabric for a long time.
I mean, even I know people didn't really care for Seaver and Fran Healy when they were in the booth, but they weren't bad. Steve Sabritsky, not bad. Some of the B talent around. Think about Colin Seaver as a broadcaster, B talent. He was. I wasn't a big Seaver fan. I mean, this booth blows the Seaver booth away. What was it, Seaver and Howie on what was SNY back then? Fran Healy and Seaver. You know, not bad. I mean, I've had Fran Healy on not this program, but another version of the program. Sweet man, great guy. But the Mets have really been lucky, and I hope that that continues. But I fear, because what people think sells now, you know, not necessarily the charm or the connection that we've experienced as baseball fans. Baseball's not about shtick a lot of times. There's shtick in there, but it's the shtick is woven in my opinion, with the connection. I think shtick over connection is bad. Shtick in the context, like what we talked about with Harry Carey and Keith Hernandez, but it's in the context of the connection with the fans. And I really believe that. And then as ballparks, look, Shea was for a multi-purpose stadium. You heard what Kurt was talking about with the Pittsburghs and the St. Louis's and the Cincinnati's ballparks. That he's right. You know, if you were thrown down in them from outer space, you wouldn't know which ballpark you were in. Maybe there were slight differences from Busch Stadium to Pittsburgh, but very, very minor. Cincinnati, very minor. And, you know, the lack of charm there. And Shea, which was built as a multi-purpose stadium in the 60s, had, you know, maybe for the wrong reasons, but had a certain amount of charm. And, you know, became, when the Mets were good and had good seasons throughout its history, became a real home field advantage. I mean, I was talking to someone the other day, a fan. We were reminiscing about the 2000 postseason and how when Alfonso tied a game in the eighth inning off of Rob Nen and against the Giants, the place was shaking. When Piazza hit the grand slam in the 10-run inning, the place was shaking. If you were in the upper deck, it was vibrating. And so many of the great memories. And it's true. And Citi Field, a beautiful ballpark in a bad neighborhood. That's, you know, I've talked about it 1,000 times, and I know that this is on the table to try to fix, but you dumped it in the worst possible place where there's nothing outside of the ballpark. And now the real concern with the new rules, and this is where I'm going, you can't have it both ways. You can't ask for a tidier game, a tight 2.5 hours, 2 hours, 40 minutes for a normal game, and then get mad when it interferes with your snacks and beer and food and ability to go to the bathroom. Ultimately, you go to the ballpark to watch a baseball game. And all this other stuff built around it, I think, was built because of our society's lack of attention. But it was also to bring in the casual fan, because you can't fill a stadium every day, 45,000 people, with hardcore baseball fans. You can't. I think financially you can't, unless you want to give away $1 seats. And even then, people have things to do. So you are going to sacrifice some of the around the stadium things, because now you have a half hour, 40 minutes less to be at the ballpark. Now, if you want to come early and partake in that stuff, you can. You could come for batting practice. You could do all the things that, as a kid growing up, I would like to do, because back then the games were in 3.5 hours. Because then 3.5 hours with another hour, being at the ballpark 5 hours is a big commitment. It's almost a job. I mean, today it was a 3-hour ball game and it went to extra innings. I mean, that's what you're looking for. The one thing you don't want to lose is the charm and the conversation and some of the things that the NBA, the NHL, because the action, the constant action. When you watch an NBA or an NHL playoff game, like I was watching the Knicks game on Saturday night, when there's action on, you're really not fully listening to what the announcers are talking about. There's no stories. You can't tell us. You can try to tell a story, and I know they have the sideline reporter pop in, but honestly, it's so much of a distraction, you're not even paying attention. You can't go on a tangent like Keith will do about his trip from Sag Harbor. Or, you know, I'm not saying they did this today, but talk about, you know, the 73 celebration of the A's was part of this weekend because the Mets were in town. Share a story about 1973. You can't do that during an NBA game unless it's garbage time. So you don't want to lose that. And truthfully, as I continue to see the new rules be implemented, I think it's basically legislated behavior that brought the game back to more scoring, maybe 90s type scoring without the steroids, brought the game back with a little bit of speed and defense and contact, where bad teams maybe are a little bit more competitive. I mean, look up and down the National League. Take Oakland. They're in the American League. There's nobody that's total trash so far. Even the Pirates are playing pretty good baseball, and they were very non-competitive last year. So, you know, and even the pitch clock, which is the genesis of a lot of the speed of the game, has really fallen into the background. Yeah, you lost a strikeout that would have ended the game with Robertson, but that's been the exception, not the rule. You ripped the Band-Aid off on that one. Eventually, you knew something was going to happen where you got an out or you lost the game. You didn't lose the game. Or something that would have impacted the final pitch or the final out of the game. It happened. And fortunately for the Mets, it was basically they had to strike out the guy twice. So I haven't seen that from the broadcasting perspective. And I will be honest, on Friday after the seventh inning when it was 13-5, I had to catch it. I checked out of that game. It was annoying me. Even with the Mets ahead, it was just so hard to watch. Especially when Nogosic got hurt, and then I said, you know, I'm not going to sit here for another 10 minutes waiting them for warm up a pitcher. I just can't. And it's Friday night. I had better things to do, to be honest with you. I know it was late. I had better things to do. Wanted to get on, you know, I wanted to, you know, whatever. So I think the new rules are not impacting anything negatively from the viewership at home experience. I think the only complaint you could have is at the ballpark, and quite honestly, that's a trade-off. Now, is that going to hurt these teams at the concession stand? Well, you're already seeing them extend the alcohol consumption into the, you know, eighth and ninth inning. Now, personally, I hear the argument on that where, you know, you don't want people driving drunk, and I am very anti buzz driving, drunk driving. Like, that's a big no-no. Like, you're endangering yourself, but you're endangering innocent people in a way that's beyond selfish and irresponsible. But you could still sell, and I don't think they should. I think they should not do that ballparks. I think that's a bad optic. However, you should also be responsible and realize that don't drink too much. Don't drink so that, you know, you go out, you know you got to drive. Don't drink when you're buzzed. I mean, that's just like going to a bar or a restaurant for that matter. You have three beers at dinner, same thing could happen. You got food in your stomach, but whatever. So, yeah, that could impact them. But, you know, look, the viewership of the game, I believe, is where the money is. Even though the cable bubble and the regional sport networks, the RSN bubble's bursting right in front of us, ultimately, the majority of people can't go spend the majority of their time at the ballpark. They're going to be spending it on TV. And if it's not impacting the relationship with the broadcasting booth, a good broadcasting booth, it's not impacting your ability to find time to invest, to watch a game and actually watch a game, not peek in and out of it. It's been a positive. And at this point, do you really pay attention to the pitch clock? Like the first couple of weeks of spring training, I was waiting for the clock. Remember the first time I watched it, I was spending more time watching the clock. Now it's like the players have just figured it out. And that's because they're big leaguers. They're the best of the best. So to me, that's really the takeaway. You know, I like to talk to Kurt about ballparks and broadcasting and get some of his stories and whatnot. But really, to bring it into the current situation, to make it topical, it was really about, are we losing a big part of what makes baseball as a sport special that the NFL can't give us, the NBA can't give us, the NHL can't give us? Only professional soccer could give it to you either, which is the breezy, conversational, night in and night out relationship with the booth, radio or TV, whatever your desire is. Some people like sit out in their yard listening to Howie and Keith Ratt on the radio. More power to you. With all the TV that we've had, it's hard for me to get into radio unless I'm in a car. That's when I listen to the radio. When I was a kid, it was different. I didn't have cable, so I had to listen to the radio probably about 65 Met games a year I didn't have access to at that time. I think it was like two-thirds TV, a third cable, maybe a little less on TV, free TV. At that point, it was Channel 9, I guess. So that's my takeaway as I wrap up here on the Talking Mets podcast. Great show. Interesting to see how things are going to transpire the rest of the road trip. Now, next Sunday is a nationally televised night game in San Francisco. That'll wrap up the 10-game road trip. Mets off to a 3-0 start. Now they could really, you know, to get a 6-4 trip, you don't have to go out and run the table in a tough place in L.A. And, you know, obviously San Francisco, I know they're under 500. Tough place to play. But, you know, we won't have a show next Sunday night, but we'll have it on Monday, whether it's Monday morning early or sometime Monday evening. That remains to be seen. We'll see what comes of that. But, you know, I'll just keep following me on Twitter, Instagram, whatever, you know, you desire, and you'll get the updates that you need. Mike Silvat, TalkingMetsPodcast.com. No G is always a place. You could always email me directly, whatever. But Twitter's usually the place I hang out the most. So anyway, want to thank Kurt McKnight for coming on. I want to thank you guys for tuning in here on this Sunday night. You could check me out all the time at the TalkingMetsPodcast.com. Send me a tweet at Mike Silva Media. And the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silvat, TalkingMetsPodcast.com. No G, Mike Silvat, TalkingMetsPodcast.com. And of course, I want to thank the good folks of the Fansided Podcasting Network for sponsoring the show. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the rest of your week. We'll be back with another Talking Mets podcast next week. Till then, take care, everybody.